Okay, so we're back again. Hope everyone enjoyed the last podcast as promised, and due to popular demand, as I indicated last time, we're going to be talking on this podcast about the mood disorders and mostly about major depression and bipolar disorder. What most people don't realize is that bipolar disorder is a pretty complicated disorder, and that there's actually not just one type of bipolar disorder. There's quite a number of varieties, and you know, it's kind of like, well, I'll take one from column A and one from column B. It gets pretty complex, but I'm going to try to make it a little less intimidating as I talk about it. There's also two varieties of the depressive disorders and the bipolar disorders, which are sort of lesser versions of the two. One is dysthymic disorder and the other is cyclothymic disorder. And as I get into this podcast, I'll talk about them each independently. So under the mood disorders category in the DSM, you have the two biggies, which is what she said. Ba-doom. I had to do that, sorry. The major depression disorders, the depressive disorders in general, and the bipolar disorders. So under the depressive disorders, what comes under that is major depressive disorder, what most people commonly call as quote-unquote depression. And the other is dysthymic disorder, which is sort of a wimpy version of depression. And again, as I've said in previous podcasts, I'm not minimizing dysthymic disorder. Think of it as a depression disorder that doesn't quite fit the depression criteria, more low-level, more chronic, and less amenable to medication in general. Likewise, you have under the other big category in the mood disorders, you have bipolar disorders, under which we have bipolar 1, and then there's like, you know, 2, 4, 6 of those, and then you have bipolar 2, which is a slightly different form, and then you have cyclothymic disorder, which, you know, here's your Miller's analogy test question. You know, depression is to dysthymic disorder as blank is to cyclothymia, right? And of course, as you know, the answer is major depression disorder is to dysthymic disorder as bipolar disorders are to cyclothymic disorder. Cyclothymic disorder, cyclothymia, is a wimpy form of bipolar disorder. If you think of it that way, it'll be easier to comprehend. Under both of those two categories, there's also the NOS, not otherwise specified, which I've talked about in previous podcasts. So there is depressive disorder, NOS, and a bipolar disorder, NOS. There's also a mood disorder due to something else. So it's not really cyclothymic disorder or depressive disorder or bipolar 1 or bipolar 2 or major depressive disorder. It's sort of a mood disorder that's due to, you know, ingesting of substances or some medical condition or whatever. And again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that because it's pretty self-explanatory. And that doesn't fall under either of the two big delineations under mood disorders. And then there's the generic, of course, mood disorder NOS, which is, you know, he's got some kind of mood disorder, but he doesn't really fit any of this other stuff, and we don't know what the heck this person's got, right? So you've heard me talk about the not otherwise specified category before. So let's go sort of right into this and talk about starting off with the depressive disorders. So before I start getting into the meat and potatoes of major depressive disorder, let me talk about what a depressive episode is, because they talk about a major depressive episode in here. And obviously, we're going to talk about that when we get into bipolar disorder also, so I figured I'd go ahead and outline that now. So most of you know, I think instinctively, in a sense, what a depressive episode looks like. But in the DSM, you have to have five of the following symptoms I'm going to talk about present during a two-week period. And these symptoms represent a significant change in functioning from a prior level of functioning. So here are the nine symptoms of which you need five. Okay, so the first one is depressed mood, which most of the day, almost every day, indicated by some kind of the person telling you, "I just feel like dog do," or other people noticing that the person walks around kind of sullen or tearful or whatever. When you're talking about kids, adolescents, or children, depression sometimes can manifest as depressed mood, quote unquote, can sometimes manifest as anger, irritability, short-patiented behaviors, that sort of thing. Kids tend to react more with anger than adults do, although I do know adults who get kind of pissy and angry too, and I'm one of them. So, symptom number two. A markedly diminished interest in or pleasure taking in almost all of the activities most of the day, the things that you used to really, really enjoy doing, and you just don't find pleasure in them anymore. Number three, significant weight loss. And this is, by the way, when you're not trying to lose weight, okay? So you're not dieting, you're not, you know, doing extra treadmill stuff, you're just losing weight, right? Or you're having a significant appetite change, which usually means you're not keeping your weight, right? Number four is either oversleeping. I should have mentioned it in number three. While most people lose weight when they're depressed, some people tend to eat and they'll actually gain weight. So you can see one or the other. Sort of tying in with that is number four, which is people either usually can't sleep, so they have insomnia when they get depressed, or more commonly, they oversleep. They have hypersomnia, so they're sleeping all the time, trying to get more energy, which doesn't help, by the way. In number five, again, this either or, so they're either very behaviorally agitated, they have a lot of what's called psychomotor agitation, or they don't have any physical psychomotor activity at all. They have psychomotor retardation, okay? And that doesn't mean their psychomotor skills fall below the IQ score of 70, right? Yeah, I know. My jokes never get any better. Just bear with me here, okay? Number six, a fatigue or loss of energy. So obviously, if your appetite's changing, if you're not eating, you know, and most of the people, if they overeat or even if they lose their appetite, they'll end up eating crappy food, which just really adds insult to injury here. So if they're doing all that, if they're having, you know, kind of behavioral agitation or whatever, and they're having problems with their sleep cycle, they're not going to have a lot of energy. So, duh, they're having fatigue or loss of energy pretty much almost every day. Number seven is they have this sense of feeling worthless and or guilty because they don't have, you know, they get sick easier because they're not eating, they're not taking care of themselves, and they feel really guilty about it, and they have all the self-recrimination, and as a result, their self-esteem and self-worth goes down like, you know, the Titanic. Number eight, obviously, if you're doing all that on a physical level, it's impacting your biochemistry of your brain, so you're unable to concentrate or focus as well as you used to be able to. These folks tend to end up being pretty indecisive. They can't make up their mind about stuff. And again, this is the kind of thing that sometimes masks in the form of a learning disorder or ADHD when they really don't have ADHD or learning disorder. They have depression, right? You can have both, but that just really makes it nasty. And number nine, they will typically have either suicidal ideation, which means they're thinking about killing themselves, and they may have a specific plan or they may not. They may just have this general sense of they just wish they were dead, or they may just have recurrent thoughts of death. It's like, you know, I'm not going to kill them. And I have a lot of people who are depressed over the years have come in and said, look, I don't want you to freak out. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to kill myself. I don't have a gun. It's not loaded. I don't have a plan. But you know what? If I didn't wake up tomorrow, you know, to go to work, or if when the morning sun arose, if I was, you know, dead in the bed, I wouldn't be upset about it. It's the sense of, you know, this would be a relief for me. Okay, so five of those nine. And obviously, as with all other disorders, these symptoms are causing these folks significant distress in a number of areas, socially, occupationally, with their families, at school. And they're not due to some ingestion of drugs. So it's not like, okay, I'm taking, you know, 2 pounds of opium every day while I'm getting depressed. Well, duh, you know, or I'm in withdrawal because I haven't had cocaine that I've been snorting like crazy and now I don't have it. Now I'm going to depression because I'm having this crappy withdrawal. This is, you know, independent of any of that stuff, right? And the symptoms are not better accounted for due to some kind of significant loss / bereavement. So you're not, you know, grieving over the loss of a, you know, favorite pet or your spouse or lover or whatever. Okay, so those are all depressed, major depression episodes, right? So if you have major depression, right, which is called major depressive episode, there's two types. You can have a single episode, which means you're currently in the throes of a single major depressive episode, right? It's not counted for by some other disorder. It's not an afterthought of being schizophrenic or on drugs or whatever. And you've never had any kind of manic-y episode. You've never been hypomanic. You've never been manic-y. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And so this is sort of your first go-around. Now, if you're a person who can trace yourself back to having several of these, then you get major depression disorder recurrent. So one is a single episode, one's recurrent. But they're the same phenomena, it's just one you've had more than one of, and one, this is your very first, you know, time at bat, so to speak. And, you know, obviously, if you've had one, it makes you a little more susceptible for a second one. Specifically, if it runs in your family, that makes you more susceptible. That's genetic loading for this. And while most depressions are caused by some external, so-called, quote-unquote, exogenous event, you know, you lose your job, you get fired from work, you get demoted, you know, your wife runs off with Pedro the Bullfighter, or, you know, your son runs off with his, you know, his school teacher, you know, to, you know, grease to start a, you know, an olive oil stomping factory or something, whatever. You know, your kid gets run over by a tractor or, you know, drunk driver, or your wife gets killed or whatever. It's usually some external event. There are a small percentage of depressions that are caused strictly by biochemistry because your brain just isn't wired correctly. And through no fault of your own, it's not like you've eaten tons of sugar or any, I mean, it's just some people are just genetically predisposed because they come with, you know, what I call foobarred wiring through no, you know, fault of their own. It's just kind of they came out of the chute with it, okay? And that's called endogenous depression in my business. I call it internal depression. Obviously, it's all internal, but it's internally caused as opposed to externally caused or exogenously caused. So for those folks who have the internal, if you will, depression, the genetically based depression, the endogenous depression, as it's called, those folks typically, you can trace it back to family members, you know, and again, the rule of thumb is the more family members you can trace it back to, the more likely it is that this depression, you know, has an internal component, and how far back can you trace it back? And I've had people come in their 30s, 40s, and 50s say, oh, geez, you know, I felt like this, thinking back on this, and now that I'm talking about it, geez, I felt like this since I was, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. That's endogenous depression, right? Unless it's dysthymic disorder, which is a lower-level form of that, and I don't want to confuse the two, but these are folks who felt really, really sad, who've operated at a really, really low level, probably, you know, for a long, long, long time. Period. And this is not their first time at bat. If you have an endogenous depression, you're probably going to have some kind of biochemical assistance, whether it's through official Western medication stuff or whether it's through some holistic stuff. And there's going to be a podcast on that specific issue of medication versus holistic stuff versus both. And, you know, there's some cases that are, you know, better handled through traditional Western medicine. I hate to say that, but I mean, that's absolutely true in my personal opinion. And I'm not a physician, so I'm just saying that, you know, from things I've seen. So it's just my personal opinion. There's some cases that I think are equally well handled using holistic medication versus more traditional Western stuff, and I personally think there's some things that are better done holistically. Again, that's just my personal opinion, you know, not as a professional, quote unquote, but I can tell you that if you look at the research data, there's a pretty good bit of data to support the things I'm saying. Okay, so I'll talk about that in a future podcast. Now, there's also a pretty good bit of data to suggest that therapy is very effective in a lot of these cases. So just even if you have an endogenous-based depression, and even if you have to be on some kind of biochemical assistance, whether it's holistic or medication or both, right, counseling is a really good way to help you deal with a lot of the aggravation and the stress and the anxiety and all the crap that goes along with this stuff, because, you know, it's pretty debilitating and pretty annoying to be depressed and feel like dog crap all the time. And there's a lot of, again, a lot of research out there that talks about cognitive behavioral therapy being extremely effective with this stuff. So I want to bring home this point, not, you know, trying to get people to call me for services or anything, but to emphasize that this is not a death sentence, you know, any more than having most of these things is the end of the world. These are manageable things. But as, you know, you folks have heard me say, you know, countless times before, and you will probably hear me say innumerable times in the, you know, in the future, this requires a lot of frickin' work. That nasty four-letter word, work. I know you don't want to hear it, but it really does. And this is not a case of just popping a pill. Because even if you have endogenous depression, popping a pill may correct the biochemistry of your brain, but it's not going to make everything go away. Okay, you've got to learn how to deal with it and what to do to make yourself feel better, and the pill doesn't teach any of that stuff. So, you know, get it out of your head that this is going to be an easy fix. Okay. The other thing you need to know is that there are a lot of different kinds of depression. There's not, even if you have just the, even if you have the major depressive disorder, some people have a more serotonin-based depression, which is a neurochemical in your brain. That's the most commonly seen form of depression, vegetative quote-unquote depression, because you look like a vegetable, you sit on, you know, like a carrot stick on a couch and watching bad reruns of Days of Our Lives and, you know, munching on bonbons or whatever, or eating, you know, simple carbohydrates or stuffing your mouth full of mashed potatoes and, you know, macaroni and cheese. But there's also depression types that hit other neuronal brain sites that aren't involving serotonin. And that's why a lot of times you'll see, you know, folks will say, oh, you know, these depression medications caused my, you know, wife to kill herself, made her more depressed, yada, yada, yada. These depression medications are horrible. You read all these, you know, these people poo-pooing all this stuff. And my response to most of that is, the depression medication itself is not bad. It's you're not using it correctly, or you've been misdiagnosed with the wrong kind of depression. Because if you get diagnosed with a vegetative depression, which is a serotonin-based, and you've really got a, you know, an epinephrine-based depression, you've got some other biochemistry in your brain going on, and you give somebody an inappropriate drug, you will. It's like throwing gasoline on a fire, which is why nobody should ever, in my personal opinion, take any sort of psychotropic, any kind of, you know, psychological medication, psychiatric meds, without having good testing. And testing doesn't mean a 10-minute interview in a doctor's office going, yep, you're depressed. It means a 1 to 2 hour intake interview plus at least one social emotional personality test, preferably something like an MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, okay? Or something, CPI, California Psych Inventory, something, okay? Because if you get diagnosed with the wrong kind of depression, the medication could actually worsen it, or at the very case, not do anything. And then, of course, you're playing this medication roulette, what I call the salad bar buffet approach, which, and I'm not slamming anybody, but which a lot of physicians seem, you know, more than happy to do. Well, let's just try this thing, and if it doesn't work, you know, 6, 8, 10 months, we'll switch, and we'll, you know. And frankly, I think that's BS, you know, a lot of, but you know, that's how a lot of physicians are trained to do it in med school. You know, it's like, we don't want to, spend a lot of money, getting patients to spend a lot of money on all this testing and stuff. Let's just try the most, you know, likely drug that's going to affect them and let's go. Well, I'm sorry. I personally think that's irresponsible as hell, okay? Because there's too many things that look like, walk like, talk like, and smell like each other, and that's just a bad idea in my opinion. And that's just one man's opinion, okay? I'm not a physician. I'm not suggesting any medical treatment. I'm just making a comment, a take, because I see this crap hundreds of times, and it's just really freaking annoying because I see people's lives messed up by this crap when they could have been avoided by, you know, spending a few dollars. And I tell people, you're being, you know, penny wise and life foolish, because damn if I take a medication without knowing exactly what's wrong with me, you know. And when I have this discussion with physicians or with nurses, you know, I say, look, somebody comes into your practice and they're saying, gee, I'm having, you know, all this GI bleeding, gastrointestinal bleeding, and I'm throwing up, and I'm, you know, I have stomach cramps. And, you know, the physician says, well, did you eat tacos with a lot of jalapenos on them the last week or two? Well, no, but I did have some, you know, really spicy, you know, Korean food. Oh, well, that's probably it. Here's a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. Call me if you don't get better. Right? Oh, no, no, no. They're going to run tests. Any responsible physician is going to, you know, send you to a gastroenterologist or some kind of specialist, or at least going to run some preliminary test on you. They're not just going to assume, yeah, you know, you ate spicy Mexican food or spicy, you know, Asian food or whatever. I'm sorry. They're not going to do that crap. Well, this is the same darn thing. You don't just throw medication for brain disorders or emotional problems at somebody without some data to support it. And the data doesn't mean you did a 10-minute interview and the guy or gal said, oh yeah, I feel stressed, or I feel depressed, or I feel crazy. Okay, great, here's your medication, bye. No, I'm sorry. That's irresponsible as hell in my personal opinion. That's just me, one guy, personal opinion, non-medical, okay? So those are all depression stuff. So make sure that you're dealing with the right kind of depression before you start taking any kind of medication or doing any holistic stuff or whatever, which is the beauty of something like the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. Excuse me, I couldn't get that out quite right, because that thing will tell you not only, you know, if you're depressed or not, and this is not like the Johnny Carson joke, how depressed are you? Well, you were so depressed, right? This will tell you how depressed you are, if you're depressed or not, if you have comorbid stuff going on, and because all the subscales on the MMPI, that's what I call the MMPI, have all these behavioral indexes on it, you kind of get a sense of what kind of depression the person has based on the behavioral stuff. And so you know to tell a physician, okay, look, this is what they're seeing. You know, here's my report. This will help guide you on your diagnosis and how to help medicate somebody. I mean, that's just responsible stuff. And every physician I've ever dealt with who was responsible loved that data. Just loved it. And I deal with some really cool physicians who I just love and adore. So, okay, so that's the story with that. So that's depression disorder, right? Now, dysthymic disorder basically is somebody who has a depressed mood, but it's not so depressed that they meet the depression criteria. That's the easiest way I can talk about it. They, you know, and while they're feeling kind of sad or depressed, quote unquote, in the common sense term, they may have a poor appetite or overeat. They may have insomnia or hypersomnia. They may have low energy or fatigue. They may have low self-esteem. They may have feelings of helplessness or hopelessness. They have concentration issues, right? That's the six criteria, but they only need two of those. And, you know, they have this sort of sad mood, and they don't meet the criteria, the full criteria for major depressive disorder. So, again, it's a kind of a lesser form, right? And that's sort of the summary of that. I don't want to spend a lot of time on dysthymic disorder. It's a more common disorder than folks recognize, and sometimes if you've got somebody that's got a fairly severe dysthymic disorder, it's kind of difficult to know where the cutting edge is between that and major depressive disorder, but if you've got enough testing and you get a good enough self-report and you get a good enough family history, you can pretty much figure out which one it is. But sometimes it's tricky. Okay, so that's your major depressive stuff. So I want to move from that into the bipolar disorders. Now, as the name indicates, which, by the way, as you may have noticed, the intro song I played was Jimi Hendrix's Manic Depression. And that's what bipolar disorder used to be called back in the day. They changed the term to bipolar because it's somebody who shifts between the two opposite poles, if you will, or two ends of the mood disorder spectrum. So they're, you know, they switch from being uber sad, uber depressed, to, you know, sort of like Beavis on a sugar rush, like, are you threatening me? You know, they're real hyper and manic-y, and they're like an ADHD person on steroids when they're, you know, like active and stuff. So let me talk about what it means to be manic and to have a manic episode, okay? So these are the criteria for mania or having a manic episode. So it's a distinct period, to define it, it's a distinct period of expansive and elevated mood, and usually involves some level of irritability. So if you get in the way of somebody's grandiose, manic-y, hyper plans, they get pretty pissy on you pretty quickly. They get pretty angry and unhappy pretty quickly. And these are periods that last at least a week, right? And usually longer. During this period of manic-y behavior, you have three or more of the following things that happen. You have inflated grand self-esteem or grandiosity. So it's kind of like some of the person all of a sudden develops this narcissistic personality-like traits. Okay, they have an incredible decreased need for sleep. And so sometimes these folks will tell you, oh, I can get 2 hours sleep and I feel like $1 million. They tend to be more talkative than usual, or they feel pressured to speak. So they're like, I call them motor mouth. They have these thoughts that sort of racing. They're racing in their head, and they can't seem to stop them. That's known in my business as quote unquote flight of ideas. Okay, so think of your ideas with wings and flying around in your head, going at Mach speed. They're easily distractible. So the least little thing kind of takes their attention away. And if you're saying to yourself, geez, this sort of sounds ADHD-esque. Well, yeah, it's not the same disorder, but you guys have heard me say this before, and you gals too, that wasn't a sexist comment. You know, what's the similarities between ADHD, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia, right? And the answer is dopamine disorder, okay? So they're all dopamine-based disorders, dopaminergic dysregulation disorders, the triple D, and I don't mean Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, my favorite food show on the Food Network channel. They all involve dopamine dysregulation in the brain, different dopamine sites, receptor sites, but they're all dopamine-based disorders. So some of this sounds like ADHD on steroids in some regards. It kind of is in a way, but only in the hypo, you know, the hyper-type stuff and the distractibility stuff. They tend to have an increase in goal-directed activity or psychomotor activity, agitation. So they're uber goal-directed. They got to get stuff done. They got to get a million things done. But they're in 14 jillion different directions. And like ADHD people, they never finish anything. And they're uber grandiose about it. So, you know, these are people, you know, like if you have a typical heterosexual kind of guy, these are guys that want to go out, you know, and get laid like 300 times in a week kind of thing. And, oh, I can leap tall buildings with a single bound, and, you know, I can have these great orgasms and all this kind of crazy crap. Which leads to criteria number 7, which is they're in over-involved in any kind of activities that are extremely pleasurable and have a high negative consequence likelihood for painful consequences. So they have very, very short-term gains and very, very quick potential for short-term and long-term pains, as I like to call it. So, you know, these folks, the folks will go into, you know, these huge buying sprees. They'll go spend thousands of dollars in like a very, very short period of time, like 3 or 4 days. Like we had a guy at the VA one time who got on a manic episode and went out and withdrew all of his family savings. It was like $70,000 or $80,000, and went out and you know, bought 4 or 5 muscle, old school muscle cars at a used car dealership, and then proceeded to go to the sort of nefarious area of town, the so-called red light district, and began to engage in this uber sexual sort of rampage for about a 4 or 5 day period. It really is not funny, but it's funny because sort of the person was like 70 years old. That's what makes it funny. Sorry, guys and gals, not meaning to make fun of somebody's pain here. And so when they finally caught up with this guy, he'd spent all but like $3,000 of his money in like 4 days. Okay, so this is the kind of thing I'm talking about, right? So obviously it's a very severe disorder. It causes extreme distress, and they're not due to something else, okay? Now, if you have what's called a mixed episode, right, that's manic or manic episode, you can have also what's called a mixed episode, which means you have a combination of mania and depression. So you have aspects that would meet the criteria for both a manic episode and a major depression episode. And that's going to be important in a minute when you think about that. Okay, so we have three types of episodes: the manic episode, the major depressive episode, and the mixed episode. Okay. You also have a thing called a hypomanic episode. Okay, and if you remember from your training in school, right? Hyper means over the top. Hypo means under or less. So a hypomanic episode is one that's not quite as agitated and, you know, Beavis on a Sugar Rush-esque as a manic episode, but it's somebody who is, you know, kind of elevated, distractible, you know, are you threatening me? But it's to a less degree and usually to a less time frame, okay? So think of hypomania as sort of the dysthymic disorder aspect, all right? It's kind of a lesser version of that. And that's going to be important when we start talking about the different kinds of bipolar disorders because, as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, there's two big types, right? One is bipolar 1 and one is bipolar 2. The saga continues, okay? So let's talk about the different kinds of bipolar 1 because this gets really complicated. And I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible without getting too bogged down into the clinical aspects. So you have bipolar 1 single manic episode. Okay, so that's a person who's had only one manic episode and no previous major depression disorder episodes, okay? And while they're having the single manic episode, it can be a mixed episode, but they can't have had any previous depression episodes, okay? Then you have bipolar 1 disorder, most recent episode, hypomanic. Remember, we mentioned that a minute ago, right? Then you have bipolar 1 disorder, most recent episode, manic, right? Which means the most recent one they had was manic, and the other one means the most recent one they had was hypomanic, right? So in the hypomanic one, there has to have been at least one manic episode in the past or a mixed episode in the past. In the most recent episode, manic, they're currently or most recently in a manic episode, and there has to have been at least one major depression episode, a manic episode, or a mixed episode in the past. So you can see this gets kind of complicated. It's not as simple as, oh, you're bipolar, right? Then you have bipolar 1, most recent episode, mixed, right? Which is exactly what it sounds like. You're in a mixed episode currently, or the most recent one was mixed, and you've had at least one mixed manic or depressive episode in the past. Okay? Then you have bipolar 1 disorder, most recent episode, depressed. So now you're in bipolar disorder, but you're currently in or just had a major depression episode, and there's been at least one mixed or one manic episode in the past. Okay? And then you have bipolar 1, most recent episode, unspecified, that we don't know what the heck you've had, but you've had to have at least one manic episode in the past, okay? So you can see this gets a little complicated. And those are all bipolar 1 disorders. And the bipolar 1s are really what most people think of when they think of bipolar disorder. That's kind of what they think of. Okay. Bipolar 2 disorder. Okay, now, bipolar 2 disorder is you currently are in or have had one or more major depressive disorders. You have the presence or history of at least one hypomanic disorder, but you have never had a manic disorder nor a mixed episode, okay? So you can have had a hypomanic episode, and you can either be in or have a history of a major depression episode, but you can't have had a manic episode, right? And that's bipolar 2. And then you specify which one you're in right now. Are you in a depressed state most recently, or in your hypomanic state most recently, right? So bipolar 2 is a slightly less flagrant version, if you will, but they're still, I mean, it's still an important disorder, obviously. Okay, then you have cyclothymic disorder, which, as I mentioned earlier, cyclothymia is kind of like dysthymia. It's like the wimpy version of bipolar disorder, right? So you have some hypomanic symptoms, and you have depressive symptoms, but you have depressive symptoms that don't meet a major depression episode. It's kind of like you have hypomania and dysthymia episodes. Okay, so that's cyclothymia. I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't want to get too technical here. Okay, so think of cyclothymic disorder, somebody who's had sort of dysthymic and hypomanic episodes, but not major depression episodes, not manic episodes. Whew, boy, that was a mouthful. So I mentioned in a previous podcast, and I think it bears mentioning again, you know, if you get somebody who's got bipolar disorder, this is not somebody who literally cycles, right? Because you have rapid cyclers, and you guys have heard that before, the term, I'm sure, before. You have the normal cyclers, and then you have people who have rapid cycling, okay? So rapid cyclers cycle faster than folks who are not rapid cyclers, okay? So generally speaking, and just to give you an indication, rapid cycling can be applied either, by the way, to bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. And in a rapid cycler, typically you have 2 months between episodes. So that's a long time, because the average bipolar person will stay in a mode for months on end, and then they'll kind of gradually cycle out of that into the next mode. So you see people who are like, oh yeah, I'm all, you know, happy 1 minute, and 5 minutes later, or 10 minutes later, or even 2 hours later, I was all depressed. Sorry, that's not bipolar disorder. That's not cyclothymia. That's something else. And it's been my personal experience and professional experience. So when you see somebody who's doing that, they're probably either histrionic personality disorder. They have both. They have a major anxiety disorder, some kind of anxiety disorder, which we talked about last time, and or depression or dysthymic disorder that are comorbid, or they have borderline personality disorder. And in most experiences, they're borderline. My experience has been they're borderline. This is not, oh, I was all happy 1 minute, and the next minute, oh, you, or the next minute, oh, I want to rip your heart out. That's not bipolar disorder. I'm sorry. And it gets misdiagnosed a boatload. Even professionals don't really get it right, in my personal opinion. And I can say that. They just don't. And it's very, very easy to mistake. If you have somebody who is uber hyper and they're ADHD, they will sometimes get misdiagnosed as being in a manic phase of bipolar disorder, being in a hypomanic phase of bipolar disorder. Bad, bad idea, right? And think about it. You know, if you see somebody in crisis, they're going to be all agitated. So if they're going to, what I call a doc in a box, right, on the weekend, or if they're going to the emergency room and they're seeing somebody for 15 minutes, or they're going into somebody who's not doing their real job, in my personal opinion, and not giving them the proper, intake interview and testing they should be giving them, in my personal opinion. You know, it's easy to misdiagnose this stuff because, again, I've said before, you can't take an X-ray or an MRI or a PET scan or a CAT scan and go, aha, there's the bipolar. Aha, there's the, like you can't a broken arm or a tumor. These things are really tricky sometimes. And you get somebody who's got really severe ADHD and they're all, in a hyper, are you threatening me mood, and really, they're uber ADHD-esque, or, you get somebody who's on a methamphetamine high, or you get somebody who's on a cocaine high, or you get somebody who's ADHD and cocained up or whatever, right? You have to really, really know your cookies and really do a thorough, competent evaluation before you start diagnosing people. I can't tell you how many hundreds of cases I have seen over the years of people getting misdiagnosed, getting put on the incorrect medication, and making their lives even worse, and then thinking, okay, well, I'm just a loser because this medication is not helping me. I can't be helped. Or they go to some therapist who doesn't diagnose them correctly because they don't do their JOB and give them the proper intake interview and testing, and they start treating something that's not right, and they don't get better, and the person thinks, oh, I'm just a loser. Therapy can't help me. Oh, my God, right? These disorders are manageable. right? Some of these disorders are not curable, right? ADHD in our current state of affairs is not curable, right? Bipolar disorder is not curable. Schizophrenia is not curable, right? But they are manageable. They are infinitely manageable, particularly ADHD and bipolar disorder. And these things are manageable, guys and gals. Don't just throw your hands up and go, oh, well, I have PTSD. I can't be helped. I have this horrible anxiety disorder. Oh, I have this horrible major depression. Oh, I have this horrible ADHD. You know, and people will sometimes try to use that as an excuse for their behavior, right? Let me say this now, and I've probably said it before, and if I haven't, shame on me. I'll say it now. Disorders are never, okay, let me say that again, never, N-E-V-E-R, never, did I mention never? Never an excuse for misbehavior. Never, ever, never, ever, ever, never. They are explanations as to why people do or don't do certain things, but they're not a get-out-of-jail-free card, ladies and gentlemen. So please do not use your disorders as an excuse for your misbehavior. And there's a lot of guys and gals out there doing that. And no offense to any of these folks when I say that, but this is particularly prone, or at least I have seen an overabundance of this with the cluster B personality disorder types, particularly the narcissists, the antisocials, and the borderlines, and the ADHD people will constantly tell me, what do you expect of ADHD? I'll tell you what I expect. I expect your butt to get in there and work harder, 10 times harder, so that you can get over it. I expect you to stop eating that crappy food, take your medication, and or do your holistic stuff, and start doing your therapy homework and stop waiting for a miracle to happening and a lightning bolt to hit your butt, because it ain't going to change. You got to get off your ass and do that nasty four-letter word, work, W-O-R-K, okay? And I'm not slamming ADHD people. I'm really, really not. I say the same thing to borderlines, and they don't like it any better. I say the same thing to bipolars. I say the same thing to major depression people. I say the same thing to people with eating disorders, okay? It's no different. You've got to work it. You can't let it work you. You've heard me say this before. Take your personal power back. Don't sit there and blame your crap on God or a disease or whatever. Get off your, or your parents or your therapist or society, get off your butt and do your damn work. And stop using your disorders as excuses for misbehavior. Doesn't fly. Okay? All of us have challenges. It's one reason I love Alfred Adler, who is just an awesome psychology guy, in my personal opinion, because he talks about natural logical consequences, which I use a lot in my work. And he talks about personal responsibility, and he talks about life handing us challenges. Life hands us things to overcome. And if you look at it in a way that allows us to see this as an opportunity for personal growth, to see this as life challenging us, to give us an opportunity to demonstrate and to work on and to hone our mastery skills, mastery over our own BS, mastery over this task that life presents to us in terms of a challenge, as opposed to going, Lord, my God, I don't know nothing about busting no babies, right, which you heard me talk about previously, or, you know, what do you expect? If you will grab this by the yin-yang, and do what you need to do and see this as a way for you to demonstrate your mastery skills and for you to learn new stuff about yourself and about life and grow and prosper, you know, this is a cool deal. And this is taking your power back. And you guys and gals have heard me say this before. Look at these life issues as challenges to show your mastery, to demonstrate your inner power and your inner strength, because every one of you people out there has got it. And I'm not just bumping my gums to make you guys feel better. Anybody who knows me knows I don't do that crap, right? This is not, it's a wonderful day in the neighborhood, right? I don't pull that game, you know. What's the old line? A homie don't play that game, okay? And I don't. I tell it like it is, right? And I call disorders by their name, even when people don't like it, and I tell them to get over it, and this is what you're going to have to do. And I, you know, call parents on their crap, and I call kids on their crap, and I call adults and married couples and partners and whatever. I call, you know, I'm an equal opportunity bigot, right? I call everybody on their stuff, and I challenge everybody to work, that nasty four-letter word. The same thing I expect of myself, okay? I'm no different. I have to do the same shit I'm asking you guys to do. Right, I don't get a get-out-of-jail-free card either, right? So when I have challenges, I have to belly up to the bar of life and start drinking seltzer water, or in my case, tonic water. I don't like seltzer, but I do like tonic water, particularly with lime in it. That's another story. With no alcohol, thank you very much. And I look at my own stuff, too. It's the only way any of us are going to change. We have to take personal responsibility for our stuff. And, you know, my sleep disorder is not my fault. And ADHD is not people's fault. And endogenous depression is not people's fault. And you know what? Bipolar disorder is a genetically determined disorder as well, right? It's somebody in your family gave it to you. Sorry, you got dealt bad cards. So same thing with schizophrenia, right? I'm sorry for you. I'm sorry for me with this damn sleep disorder. Right? And it's not my fault, but it is my responsibility to figure out what I'm going to do about it. Right? And whining, bitching, moaning isn't the what to do about it. Right? I have to figure out ways to compensate for it. And it's hard. I'm telling you, it's really flipping hard. And I miss out on a lot of opportunities that I could do in the morning because I can't do mornings because my morning starts at 12 or 1 a.m. I'm up before most of you guys and gals are up. Right? So people are like, oh my God, just sleep till 1:30. Yeah, but you know what? I'm up till 5 and 5:30, and I'm doing work during those times. So I'm up earlier than you are. So, you know, stuff it. But the problem is I can't get up and do a normal job. I can't get up and be to work at 8 o'clock or 7:30 or 9 o'clock or even 11 o'clock. I can't do it. I can't function. I don't. You know, that's just part of my curse. That's part of my sleep disorder I inherited from my mom's side of the family. And it sucks, but it's reality. Now what I have to do is figure out a way I can accommodate my reality and at the same time live in a world populated by a majority of people who don't have this sleep disorder. Because, you know, this is about you accommodating your pathology. This is not about asking the world to give you a get-out-of-jail-free card. Hey, so please don't ever try to use that excuse on people. It doesn't fly in my therapy office, and it doesn't fly in the real world either. Okay? The only way to get over this stuff is to accurately diagnose it. Go to somebody who knows what they're doing. Don't go to some generalist. And I tell you, you know, everybody the same thing. If you have one of these managed care card dillies and you have managed care, which I like to call mangled care because that's what the hell it is as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not slamming you guys because a lot of you folks don't have a choice. You work for a big corporation that buys the insurance and you have to take what they have you. But let me tell you what, do yourself a favor. If you've got some complicated psych disorder or set of psych disorders, you get some kind of complicated condition and it hasn't worked, you're not getting over it real easily, pony up the bucks and go see somebody that's out of your network that knows what the hell they're doing. You know, call your state psych association, look them up on the internet, you know, do a Google search on cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever, do a Google search on bipolar disorder, figure out who works. You know, when you call the doctor's office, ask them, you know, if you get their secretary or get their assistant, ask them, what does Dr. So-and-so specialize in? Does Dr. So-and-so do this? Does Dr. So-and-so do that? What's Dr. So-and-so's credentials? That's not being rude. That's being an informed consumer. And let's face it, we're providing a service to you guys and gals out there. By God, you should know what you're getting. Okay? Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to say, what does the doctor do? What does the doctor don't do? And if you've got something really funky or something you've been struggling with, pony up the bucks and go to somebody outside of your network if you can possibly afford it. And I know there's folks out there who can't, and I'm not slamming you people because I understand money's an issue. Honest to God, I get that. But there's a lot of you for whom that's not an issue. And if it's not an issue and there's a way you can do it, you need to try to do that because nothing is more important than you and your health and your well-being. And it's worth the extra money if you can possibly afford it to find somebody who's a specialist that deals with complicated issues, that deals with bipolar disorder if that's what you have, or deals with post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression or whatever. And get help from somebody who knows their stuff. And don't be afraid to ask them questions. Right? And if they don't call you back, if you get a voice machine and they don't call you back within a day or two, they're rude bastards. Excuse my French, but they're rude bastards unless they're on holiday. Right? And if they don't call you back, call somebody else. And, you know, if you have to, go in and spend some money and meet them and chat with them. Talk with them 10 minutes on the phone. I mean, when people call me in my office for the first time for services, I spend probably anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes on the phone with them, making sure I'm right for them, making sure that my therapy style is right for them, making sure that I'm qualified in terms of my experience. Because, you know, when you get licensed generically, you know, it doesn't, I know that you're supposed to be able to see everything, but I can't, I'm not God. There's a certain group of folks that I work incredibly well with, that I'm really well versed in their pathology and their specific needs. And there's a group of people that I just suck donkey balls with. Let's just be perfectly blunt, okay? And I don't try to act like I'm good with those people, because I know I'm not. But I have a referral base of folks who are really awesome with those people, and I refer them out because that's what I want. I want the best for somebody. I don't want to pretend that I can do something when I can't, because I'm doing a disservice to everybody. So spend some time with the person on the phone. If they won't spend time with you explaining what their office procedures are and what they do and what they don't do and what insurance they take or don't take or what kind of expertise they have or don't have, right? That's important stuff. If they're not willing to do that, call somebody else and find somebody till you find somebody that matches your personal style. You got to be comfortable with them, as well as them being experts, quote unquote, in the field of what you need. Okay? So I hope that helped, folks. Never give up. You know, everybody that listens to this podcast that is suffering deserves to get better, but you're not going to get better if you give up. Don't ever give up. Do what you can do. Do to the best of your abilities. Don't use your stuff as excuses. Face it head on and beat the crap out of it. Because every one of you, I personally believe that, you know, most of the people I see in my, the vast majority of people I see in my office that call me for services or come in for services are able to do what they need to do. They're just not all willing to do it. And in some cases, they don't believe they can do it. And that's really important. They got to believe it. Can't believe it, you're not going to do it. I mean, as you believe, so shall you do. And that is so true. And I wish I could take credit for that, but I can't. A very learned friend of mine said that to me many years ago when I was too young and dumb and stupid to figure out the uber impact of that. And it took me probably seven, eight years to kind of go, oh, shoot, I get it. Duh. You know, what you going to do? Okay. All of us are dumbasses at one time or another, and I'm no exception. Thanks for listening. I hope you guys and gals out there found this informative. Stay tuned. Next podcast probably won't be for a week or so. And my guess is the next podcast, unless I get an overwhelming request for something else, is going to be on holistic approaches and non-traditional medical approaches and comparing those to medical approaches and talking about some things to do for various stuff. So stay tuned. And, you know, if any of you out there want to hear a podcast on something, if I feel I'm competent to do it, I will. If I don't, I'll tell you I'm not, you know. And there's plenty out there that I'm not. So don't feel hurt or slighted if I don't do a podcast on something, because if you ask me to do something I'm not qualified to do, I'd rather just tell you, no, I'm sorry, I'm a moron on that. I can't do it, than to feed you full of sheep dip and inappropriate information. But I can probably send you the person that can give you the right answer. Hang in there. Never give up. Take back your personal power. It's worth it. Later.